We talked about a few things so far. We talked about how nothing's ordinary. We're on this journey, hauling 67, that's a Georgia term. We're hauling 67,000 miles an hour around the sun on planet Earth. We've done pretty good so far. We've covered some ground, as you can see in the diagram that's coming up. There it goes. We've already covered 67 million miles, 42 days. And the reality is for now, it still feels pretty possible. But as the year goes by and we revisit our journey, it's going to become more and more urgent for you and me that one more trip around the sun, one more opportunity to realize things, one more chance for God to really do something significant in our lives just went by. So we talked about how nothing's ordinary. We talked about how we're amazingly small. We celebrated that. We talked about this incredible divine invitation that's on the table in our third week together. And then last week, we talked about our opportunity to take the ability God has given us and to use it for His glory. We said our ability is God's gift to us, but what we do with our ability is our gift to God. And at the least, anybody in this story, this parable of the talents Jesus told, had a 75-pound bag of gold. You could do a lot with that in Jesus' day. So God's put something in your life, and He wants you to see this as an opportunity to maximize your gift, your ability, your talent, your aptitude, your opportunity and experience in life for a purpose way bigger than yourself. And then today we come to this amazing part of our journey, and I can't think of anybody to help us get a perspective shift better than someone who's actually been off the planet Earth. I mean, like way off the planet Earth and lived in space. And so today, to give us a new perspective on numbering our days, I want you to welcome with me our friend, astronaut Shane Kimbrough, is going to come up and join us today. Yeah. Welcome.
Thanks.
Glad you're here.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pat and City. Thanks.
Oh, it's so good to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Amazing. Amazing day for all of us, and there's so much to talk about, but I want people to know that you're more than an astronaut. That is very amazing. Only a few people have been to space, actually, relatively, about as many people as would comfortably fit in the theater at North Atlanta High School, where you guys are at Cumberland right now. That's about how many people have been in space before. I think the number is around 539 people, give or take. Something close to that.
That's right.
I always looking at Shane like for backup, like that's good.
That's good. And
think about how crazy that is. Of the billions of people who've lived on this planet, only 539 people have ever been into space. So you've got a perspective, a viewpoint, but that's not all. A couple things real fast, and we'll touch on a lot of this. Your first mission to space was 2008 aboard the space shuttle Endeavour. You were in space for 15 days. This is NASA talk here. 20 hours, 29 minutes, and 37 seconds approximately. You did two spacewalks totaling 12 hours and 52 minutes. In 2016, your second mission, you went to the International Space Station, which you became the commander of in October of 2016. You were there for roughly 6 months, 173 days. You did six spacewalks on that mission, 26 plus hours. That's your total spacewalk. Spacewalks, you've spent 26 hours plus just walking around in space, just floating around in space.
Doing a little work at the same time.
189 days you've spent in space. Before that, you graduated from West Point. You went to Lovett School, by the way, here. Any Lovett Lions in the house? Oh, isn't that awesome? Did that not make you feel great?
Fired up.
We don't have a real big private school crowd here at the 1145. Just regular people like me went to Campbell High School, Smyrna. So you went to Lovett, not too far from where you guys are sitting at Cumberland right now. You went to West Point. You graduated in 1989. By the way, you were the captain of the baseball team at West Point. You were a pitcher. What was your best pitch, by the way?
Split-finger fastball.
All right, bring it. You went into the Army Aviation School. You were in the 24th Infantry Division in Desert Storm, flying an Apache helicopter. And so thank you for serving our nation and protecting our freedom.
Thank you for your support. Thank you.
You became in 1994 commander of an Apache helicopter company. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's a bunch of Apache helicopters, and one of them's pretty bad, so a whole bunch of them is trouble coming. You retired from the Army as a colonel, Congratulations again, and thank you for serving our country. We salute you in all of the effort that you have given to this nation and to the international community by serving us in space. You graduated from Georgia Tech with a master's degree. A few more tech people than Lovett Lyons, but not many. All the smart people go to a different church, apparently. We got a lot of Georgia Bulldogs here today, though. It's not to say they're not smart. But when you graduated from Tech, you went back to the U.S. Military Academy to be an assistant professor. I'm just covering some bases so that you know, I got no business up here right now. Assistant professor in mathematical sciences. Your wife, Robbie's here with you today. She's absolutely incredible, amazing. You have twin daughters, Taylor and Caitlin, one at Baylor and one at TCU. Which school you like better?
I can't answer that.
Yeah. But they're both really cheap, so that's awesome.
They are. We got that going for us.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And then you've got a son, Zach. Man, what an amazing, that's like the tip of the iceberg in your life. And I know a lot of people ask you this, but I kind of wanted to know, did you always know this was going to be your path? Like, I'm going to go to space. Or was there a moment along the way that you went, oh, God has given me a certain gift, aptitude, ability, and I think it's to launch off this planet?
Great question. I always wanted to be an astronaut ever since I was a little kid. I mean, those of you my age remember the men walking on the moon, right? So back in the early 70s, I was only four or five.
Yeah. Shout out there.
Four or five then, but I was lucky enough that my grandparents lived across the river from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. So we spent a lot of time down there just in general. And so my grandfather, with no kidding, dragged me out to see anything that was launching. And so I kind of had it in my DNA from an early age, whether I wanted to or not, that was kind of cool. But then, as you guys probably remember, gathering around a TV, it may have been black and white at that time, but the whole nation really stopped to watch the Apollo missions and the men walking on the moon. So I did say at that age, even though I was only probably four or five, that I want to do something that cool, that different. Of course, I wasn't quite qualified at that moment. So I had to move along through life, but I always had that in the back of my mind. As was mentioned, I went to West Point. At that time, when I made that decision, I actually gave up on this astronaut dream. I didn't know you could be in the Army and be an astronaut. So I said, no problem. I'm going to go be an officer in the military and hopefully get to fly something if I get lucky, and I'm just go, you know, serve our country the best I can. Shortly after being in the Army for a few years, I was actually here in Atlanta.
Let's just pause there for a minute, because you were actually in the Army, and this is pretty intimidating version of Shane Kimbrough right here.
Nice. That's young Shane.
And then we've got, that's what you were.
This is over in Iraq.
Okay, and then that's
That's a Fort Bragg there. So, those are pretty nice machines, as you might imagine. They can do some damage, and a company of those is made up to six to eight of those, so a lot of power on the battlefield. So
amazing.
Kind of get back to where you're going. Shortly after I was in the Army for a few years, I was up here in Atlanta for an Army Aviation Convention, so we get
that
together.
That sounds so exciting.
It's awesome. So you learn from all these great people. You see all the new gadgets that are out. But during that convention, I saw a gentleman walking around in a blue flight suit, so I'm like, hey, dude, what do you do? He's like, I'm an Army astronaut. I'm like, wait, what? So the Army has astronauts? So most of the Army still today has no clue that we have astronauts. And that's okay. That's fine. I was in the same boat back then. So we started talking, and that flame of that dream kind of rekindled there. And I really kind of started pursuing it. I needed to go to graduate school, got the opportunity to come to Tech, as you mentioned, and then just continued to be the best officer in the Army I could. Whether or not I got to be an astronaut was, you know, totally up to God. The chances aren't zero of being an astronaut, but they're pretty darn close to zero. All right, just for reference, the selection we just had 18,000 applicants, and we selected 12 people. So you Georgia Tech folks can help the Georgia folks out to figure out that's a very, very small number. All right, so just kidding. My wife went to Georgia, so I got to be careful here.
Oh, man.
Where do you go next?
So one of the great moments we had, and it wasn't the last time we saw each other, but not too far from the last time we saw each other, was this moment at Passion. It's a pretty extraordinary opportunity we had. to link live to you at the International Space Station for the last session of Passion 2 years ago at the Dome. What were you thinking? You're orbiting the Earth and about to talk to 55,000, mostly 18 to 25-year-olds, about life on board the space station.
What a great moment. A huge morale booster for me. It was about midway through my mission, and it just kind of really got me over the hump of kind of on the downhill side of my mission. The mission was amazing, don't get me wrong, but this was a moment that definitely defined my mission for me personally. Knowing I was and feeling the energy while we were talking to 50,000+ college kids was absolutely incredible. So those of you that were there, thank you for all that energy you provided. A lot of my crewmates were coming over to see what was going on because it was so crazy on board. We couldn't see you guys, but we could hear you and feel the energy. So that was really incredible. Now, this doesn't happen easily. It had never happened at a venue that big. So we had lots of folks on the NASA side, lots of folks on your team, on the Passion team, trying to make the impossible happen. And it pretty much got to, it wasn't going to happen, as you remember. But God finally said, it's going to happen.
It was a miracle, I'm telling you, that it happened for a lot of reasons. I mean, A, we had a link to the station during the worship, the songs, and even an hour before. And we were listening to another astronaut talk to some other people somewhere in the world. It was fascinating. But the link was perfect. It was as clear as you and I. I'm like, this is going to work. The last song is being played. I'm walking to the stage, and our team says, not going to work. We lost Shane. And I'm like, no, it's going to work. It's going to work. And they say, no, not we lost Shane. The Johnson Space Center has lost their connection to the International Space Station. I was like, oh, that's a problem. They said they're rebooting their connection. And I just said, Lord, this is our moment. And we need a miracle. Because very soon after that, you were going to go into some zone of your orbit that wasn't even going to work for our deal. So we had to have this thing connect. I remember walking on stage, and our team is amazing here, and they were just giving me that move on, go to the next thing, it's not going to happen, nothing's happening, it's not happening. And I'm standing on stage in front of tens of thousands of people going, we're trying to do something right now that's not very easy to do, so we're just going to wait a moment, see what happens, so just bear with us. They're like, no, move on, done, finished. Next thing, so I'm like, just bear with us, we're working on something. Give us a moment, if you could just kind of be quiet in the room. And they're like, dude, ain't happening. And then in my ear, Shane says, Louie, I can hear you fine. And I'm like, thank you, Lord. This is it.
Awesome.
It's a miracle. And the next thing I know, there you appear on the screen. The reason we did that, Shane, and it's important for you to know this, wasn't just because we wanted to be, that's cool. I didn't know we were the biggest thing space stations ever connected to before. But we wanted people who are not preachers and pastors and church planters and worship leaders and missionaries in that sense of the word to know that they're important in the economy of God. Because in that arena are people like you who are gifted to do different things like all these people are today. And we just wanted people to know that this is how the world sees the light and the love of Jesus, is by all of us in our specific sphere being great at what we do and doing it in a way that has a bigger meaning and a bigger value.
Amen. So again, an incredible event for me, and just the dialogue we had was so powerful. And since that moment, I mean, almost everywhere I go, somebody would be like, you're the guy at Passion! So they like recognize me from that event, and obviously it had a big impact on so many folks. So I'm just honored to be a part of that.
You went into the space program in 2004. You got into the astronaut program. Zero chances, basically. And you got in. I mean, what was it about you? Because everyone here is a lot of people here are facing something like that. My dream is a very small percentage chance. What was it about you that caused you to keep going? And what do you think it was about you that allowed you to make it other than the sovereign plans of God?
I think God's given me one of my talents, certainly is determination and challenging myself always. And I have done that since high school. It's just been something kind of built inside of me to just do something that's either impossible or seems like it's impossible and to keep going. And that's not why I became an astronaut. Obviously, I had a passion for that. It was certainly a far-reaching thing. My Army career was a bit in jeopardy by taking this chance on being an astronaut, so it didn't come for free. And we knew that, Robbie and I knew that, but we made our little calculated decision that that's the way we wanted to go and give it a shot. And why I was selected versus the other 100 that came to interview is completely in God's hands. It was, you know, we're all completely overqualified at that point, and it came down to personality and just who God wanted to be there in the end. So I feel very honored to serve our nation and serve humanity in that capacity now.
Amazing. That's incredible. I've never been into space, contrary to popular opinion, and I'm not an astronaut. I've read a lot of books on astronomy and been to NASA many, many times, and been up in the shuttle simulator, and I think at best I'm probably a half astronaut, not a full astronaut.
I like it.
So you get the message. I don't know if it was what year it was in that, I can't remember technology in that year, but you got a phone call, you got a message, you got an email, you're going into space.
So that was a phone call from my boss, Steve Lindsay, at the time, the chief of the astronaut office. And I'd worked a long day as a CAPCOM, which is a position in the Mission Control Center. It's typically an astronaut, but it's the one that talks to the crew. So it's a really important position. You kind of get the crew through their day, and you're talking to them through all their procedures and everything. So I was running from that, ironically, to my 8-year-old's football practice at the time, so which I thought was extremely important at the time, right? But I happened to go by my desk and check, and there was a message, and our boss had said, "Hey, come see me." So I'm like, what did I say that I shouldn't have said, you know, today to the crew? I did something wrong for sure. And go down to his office. There's a line of people, and I'm like, I've got to get to football practice. That's way more important than talking to the boss. Anyway, for whatever reason, I stayed, and he called me in and said, "Shane, you ready to go fly in space?" I'm like, absolutely. That's why, you know, of course, that's why we're always there. But, you know, an astronaut's career, most of it is actually spent on the ground, unfortunately. So these are rare moments when you get a chance to go fly in space. So about a year after that is when we launched on Space Shuttle Endeavour.
So you went up on STS-126 and November 14th, 2008. Okay. Just talk us through this, because you're in that rocket.
Yeah, so we're up on the top of this big bomb that's exploding right now, I guess is the best way to put it. Millions of pounds of thrust. An incredible moment. I'm sitting there just very relaxed. I knew I had tons of people praying for me, and I was exactly where I was supposed to be in life. I just felt that genuinely. We start lifting off here. The first couple of minutes are really crazy, where you're shaking around and a lot of power, a lot of, you know, craziness going on, and I'm just laughing like a little kid the whole way. So really professional at the time, right? So, but you know, we get going. After a couple of minutes, the solid rocket boosters fall off, and then it just gets really smooth, and it's pure acceleration at that point. It takes 8.5 minutes to get to space with the space shuttle. So we've gone from zero on the launch pad to 17,500 miles an hour in 8.5 minutes. So you smart folks can do the math. The acceleration was pretty cool, all right? So that's why I was laughing for 8.5 minutes straight. So really a great time.
Wow, so you're in space. You get to that moment where main engine cutoff and just everything's quiet. It's crazy. You've had all this, like, explosion going on in your seat. So you had a simulator. You've been in that.
Absolutely.
And it's teaching you what this is going to be like. But then they strap you to that thing. What's the gap between this is the simulator and this is like...
Yeah, there's no comparison with what you're feeling, what your body is going through, what your mind's going through, the acceleration. You just cannot duplicate that unless you do it for real. So the simulator is great for procedures and training on what it's going to look like on the displays and all that good stuff and how to manage the vehicle if there's issues. But just to experience it is absolutely incredible.
And then all of a sudden you're in space. I'm wondering, you know, I think a lot of us want to know, at some point you saw the Earth for the first time. Can you tell us what point in your day was that? What kind of glimpse did you get? Do you remember what you saw? And what was that like?
It was a few hours after we took off, actually. My first task was to open the payload bay doors of the shuttle. So it's a real big thing. We have to do it for heating, otherwise the vehicle overheats. So it's an important mission. I got the doors open with some commands, and once that happened, I just kind of stood there for a minute and looked at our planet. and absolutely incredible. Now, we're not high enough to actually see it like a ball, like you see the pictures from the moon that the astronauts took, but you know, we're still looking at Earth like this, you know, not even all the way around, but really spectacular to see the thin layer of atmosphere, for one, that protects all of us here from living and dying. Absolutely way thinner than I expected, all right? So it gave me an appreciation that, man, we've really got to protect this environment we have, otherwise we're going to go away, right? So that was a cool thing. Another was just the striking beauty of our planet. No matter where we were flying over, you know, the Bahamas are an easy one. That's absolutely stunning from anywhere. But the deserts of Africa, the deserts of Australia, or the Red Sea, or the Middle East, everything just had this striking beauty to me that I hadn't really noticed before.
Talk about coming home that first time. You know, it's re-entry, but just re-entry. I know you can talk about the technicality of the shuttle landing, but you've been in space. And like the next day, you're at Wendy's, you know. How do you, you know, I read about Bono, and they said when U2 would go on these big world tours, and they turned into these uber rock stars and got so full of themselves, when Bono would come home, his wife would make him stay at a hotel in town for like 2 weeks until he was able to re-enter normality a little bit, and then he could actually spend the night at the house. And I'm thinking, that's just a rock tour with U2, that you were like up orbiting the Earth. How do you come back down into normal life?
Yeah, I think you gave my wife a new idea there, Louie. But, so re-entry, it's a little bit different for everybody. Your body has gone through some really crazy adjustments, coming through the atmosphere and feeling gravity again. And some people it makes you get ill, some people it doesn't. It's just you're all different and you just got to figure it out when you get home. We were supposed to land in Florida, like all shuttle missions were planned to do. We missed it by a little bit, ended up in California because the weather was really bad in Florida.
I did that on a Delta flight the other day.
But beautiful day out there. Our families were in Florida waiting on us, so we actually joined back up the next day in Houston. It was a really great time, had a nice ceremony, and you get back to the house. And the funny thing that part of reentry coming back home is we as astronauts have a little trouble with things like this, all right? Because we've been like in space, when you're done with this, you just let it go and it sits there, right? And so we break a lot of plates and glasses. It's one of the reentry
problems. Finished with my dinner. I'm just sending my plate to the kitchen now. On Earth.
So my wife was smart, got ahead of that curve, and we were eating off plastic plates and plastic glasses for a little while. So.
Well, you got home, and then you got a new assignment. You knew you were going to go to the space station for a while. Things had changed. Shuttle program's gone. You're going to go up on a Russian rocket, Soyuz rocket, which means you got to go to Russia first, and then you got to go to Kazakhstan. And we've all been to Kazakhstan. It's so easy to go there. You're going to go out to the middle of literally nowhere to get launched up on this Russian rocket. This is what that guy looks like.
Let's much watch smaller the launch than
and
shuttle.
Then you tell us a little bit about it. Can we get a little more volume if we do have a little bit there?
Can see the engines firing now, going up to flight speed and liftoff. Shane Kimbrough, Sergei Ryzhikov, and Andrei Borisenko blasting off from Kazakhstan, making their way towards the International Space Station.
This was a really smooth ride. I got to give it to the Russians. I mean, it was super smooth the whole way up. They're a little slower than us. They take about 9.5 minutes to get to space versus 8.5. But it was a great ride. You see us here all tucked in, nice and tight in that vehicle. The unfortunate thing for us was we had to stay in there for 2 days before we got there. So the standard way is about 6 hours to get to the space station. We got lost, I guess, and it took us a couple of days. Now, we're on a new vehicle, an upgraded vehicle, so they wanted us to do a bunch of testing on it, and so that's why it took us a couple of days to get there. So but I was happy to see the space station.
You got there. We got some video of that. Actually, you're arriving to dock, and then the hatch opening is going to happen here.
Yeah, this was a very happy moment. Our vehicle, for some reason, was really cold, so we were freezing and just could not wait to get to the space station. Our Russian commander's making sure that everything's going well here, Sergei Ryzhikov, and he flies us in there just beautifully. Once we dock, it takes a couple hours for all the pressures and accelerations to equalize before we can go over and see our crewmates. So there were three people on the space station waiting on us. Takuya from Japan, Kate from the U.S., and Anatoly from Russia. And we got to overlap with them only about a week, unfortunately, until they came home, and then we were up there by ourselves for a little bit before another crew joined us.
This is going to be fantastic.
Here's a good
first
moment.
Cosmonaut coming out. Good job. His family's happy. They can see that he's well. Second cosmonaut coming out. Family gets a good look at him. See how good he looks. Everybody at home's happy. Now the American astronaut comes out, and everybody at home is going to get a great look at him.
Oh, beautiful.
I mean, if only that guy had like a MARTA logo on the back of his coat. This man trained his whole life to go into space. I'm going to just get right in front of the camera and block that view.
Poor Andre.
How long was it before you saw a clip of that?
Not long. My friends were emailing me that link and that clip and pictures of it. It was pretty funny. So we got a lot of mileage out of that.
Wow. So you're on the space station, 254 miles above the Earth, traveling 17,150 miles an hour. So let's think about it. I don't want to get bogged down, but we're spinning around. We talked about 1,000 miles an hour, a little less here in Atlanta on our axis. But yet you're flying around us while we're spinning 1,000 miles an hour. You're going a little faster than us, 17,150 miles an hour. You see a sunrise every 92 minutes, 16 trips around the Earth a day. And that's your living situation for the next 6 months of your life.
Pretty amazing when you think about it like that. Of course, we're up there and we just get to work and we go to sleep and we get up and we start working again. Every now and then we'll get a chance to look out the window and somewhat appreciate kind of what you were just talking about there, which is really special. The sun's either setting or rising every 45 minutes. So it's pretty crazy for your brain to get around that, right? And like, should I be sleeping? Should I be awake? What's going on here? And thank goodness there aren't windows all over the space station. We never get anything done. So I'm sure that was part of NASA's plan. But we have a couple great windows. The cupola is an incredible module that's all windows now that looks at planet Earth all the time. And if I ever got a free 90 minutes, which was maybe once during the whole mission, I sat in there and went around the Earth one time just looking at our planet and taking pictures. It's really special.
You became a great photographer while you were there. Your Instagram, by the way, has got some phenomenal shots on it. And still to this day, you repost a lot of the great ones. So if you want to follow Astro Kimbro, Astro_Kimbro, you can see some of those great shots there. But it's just all kind of mind-boggling for all of us. A couple things. One, you call people, like on the phone. Like my phone would ring, and it would be a Houston number, and then I learned that it's one of these numbers is coming from the Space Center in Houston via you. So every time they would come in, I would just put them in my contacts as Shane in Space. So the phone would ring, and it would be, and the first couple times you called me, I wasn't around, and you left me voicemails like, "Hi, Louie, it's Shane, just checking in with you up here in the space station." And I was just like, how is this possible? You do stay connected, though, and technology is pretty amazing. And we had an election, so you voted from space.
I did.
And tell us who you voted for, why, what process you went through. You happy about your decision? How'd you do that? Did you just like secretly tell somebody, don't tell anybody,
So they sent me a ballot up, a secure ballot up via email, and I filled it out and returned it, and that's how I voted from space. So it was quite an honor to do that, even though I was off the planet, but certainly a right and a duty that we have to do that. So it was neat to be able to have that privilege.
You gave Shelley and I a Skype tour of the space station. And then we had, I don't know if we'll get a chance to talk about it, a really great Sunday worship time together where we had Christians leading worship, some of our team, some of our pastors, Shelley, myself, up in my office, and we were Skyped with you, and we had worship and prayer. It was right before you came back. Some of those moments were so surreal for us, but you showing us around, and we don't have a picture of this, but you said, and this is where we sleep, and you were in this, you know, square-shaped area. And you said, I sleep in here. Doors open, like, kind of like a phone booth. I sleep in there. Other dude sleeps in here. Other dude sleeps up here. And the other dude sleeps down here. And we're like, what? How do you sleep? How do you go to the bathroom? What? How does this work?
Really the important stuff. So sleeping, you get in your kid in telephone booth size little room. It's a great place to get away. It's a private space. You close the doors. It's completely soundproof. So it's a really nice capability. You have a sleeping bag in there that you attach to the wall. You can be right side up, upside down. Doesn't matter. So that's kind of cool.
You have a pillow in there?
No pillow. So your head just kind of bobs, I guess is the best thing. If you want to get a pillow, some people do it and they like strap it to their head. You know, and that way they kind of feel like there's a little pressure in their head. But you just float in your sleeping bag. A lot of people, if you sleep like with your arms up, they'll put some bungee cords around their arms to give you a little pressure. But in general, they're kind of just floating there. I slept really well, so I didn't have any issues with that.
And do you know if he slept upside down or right side up, or did it matter?
Doesn't matter. It's pretty. It's an incredible environment to live and work. I mean, it's just absolutely just cool, right? I mean, you're flying around everywhere. You don't have a choice. You just fly around everywhere.
He showed us the treadmill. It was on the wall, and he said, "Here's our treadmill." And I assumed it would fold down, and he would get on it. Yeah. And he said, "No, we just get on it on the wall."
Yeah. So we're running parallel to the ground, so to speak, you know, as we would see it. So it's kind of weird to come around the corner sometime initially and you see somebody running. You're like, how's that possible? But you're like, we're in space. It doesn't matter. So
we have some home movies, a couple of you showed us. You opened a few windows.
Wow.
And that's what we did. You just put the camera out the window. It's the first time I'd ever looked at the Earth in real time before. And then you said, I want to show you all this part.
This is out of the Japanese module here. It has some really nice windows that look to the left or the port side of the space station.
No way.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sorry for all the technical terminology. High vocabulary skills. And then this next one is a little clip you were showing us of the dining room, if you will.
Oh, yeah. There's our oven, and here's our dining room table. We have all the important things like sriracha and ketchup. And so everything has Velcro on it, or it has tape that you stick things on, obviously, for obvious reasons. Eating is fun. You're just floating things around each other. And, you want a bite? Here you go. And you float it over to them. And it's just don't do that at home, kids. But it's a lot of fun to do it in space.
So what did you put the sriracha on? And how did that work exactly?
Yeah, so tortillas are a huge staple up in space. We must have a factory that's up there I'm not aware of, but we have so many tortillas, so they're just great, really, vehicles for things to go on that we can, easily fly around and eat, kind of get into your next event. So sriracha is a great kind of, it's obviously a liquid, but it's a paste for other things to stick to, all right? So if you had a meat or a chicken or something you wanted to stick in there, if you just threw it in there with tortilla, it would just bounce out. But if it has sriracha or ketchup or whatever you want, you just throw it in there and it sticks to it. So it gave you some, some adhesive, I guess, for your meal. Yeah. Like lunch today, right?
Exactly. So you had other people up there with you, 6 people?
Correct.
Total. And you wouldn't see them on a normal day. They'd be in their particular area of the station working on whatever they're working on. You'd be in your area, but you'd meet up, or how did communal life work?
Yeah, so you mentioned there were 4 of us living on the U.S. side of the space station. There are 2 folks that lived on the Russian side. The Russian side only has 2 sleep stations, so 2 cosmonauts. They had 3 while we were up there, so the third one lived on our side. And when I was there for most of my time, it was a French, another U.S., Peggy Whitson, who set all the records for U.S. in space and spacewalks and all that stuff. So it was just an honor to be with her and Thomas Pesquet, who's just an absolute budding superstar from the French nation, and it's just great being with them. We would see each other most of the day, but not necessarily working on the same things. We would just kind of pass, and flying by each other, say hello, and as we're off to our next event. But we would come together for meals. Peggy and Tamar and I would eat all meals together, and then we would join our Russian colleagues on Friday and Saturday nights as we would eat dinner together. So Friday nights were all spent in the Russian segment, eating their wonderful cuisine out of their canned, fatty fish-looking stuff that looked awful, but it tasted amazing. All right, so ours was kind of on the healthy side, very bland, but I guess good for you. So it was a treat to go down there and kind of indulge in some really good tasting food.
They
got to
bribe them because they put them up there for like 15 years. They got to do something to keep them up there.
So that was good. And then on Saturday nights, we kind of return the favor and have dinner on the U.S. side. Usually have dinner and a movie on Saturday nights, so we'd be eating and then throw up a movie and watch it together. So got to share life together, even up there.
So cool. You took some things up there into space for a lot of people. I know that you took, I don't know how you do that, but you take a bunch of stuff up there for friends and family. And you took, I didn't know what to really send, and I had to get it prepared in a hurry. And so I sent my notes for my message at Passion that year that you talked. So they went up into space, which is pretty cool. And I sent a couple pages from my Bible, not this one that I'm preaching out of, but my other Bible. So these guys went 76 million miles with you around the earth a bunch of times. And then you sent me a photo. It's really kind of you that you took this into space. And you took a photo of this in the couple of...
Surprise.
Yeah. Talk about being in charge. You arrive at the shuttle. There's a crew there.
Right.
And then they leave, and then you took command of the crew. Correct. For a bit. What is that about?
A huge responsibility when you think about it. And as long as you have crewmates like I did, it's a very easy job. Okay. We don't all have the luxury of that sometimes in our jobs and when we're in leadership positions. But I had plenty of training, of course, through the Army and through other stages in my life to be a leader. And, you know, I got my expectations out early of what I expected of everybody, and I literally didn't have to say another word after that. So the crew was absolutely incredible. We broke all kind of records for the amount of science and research we were doing while we were up there. The number of vehicles that showed up with cargo, we have five of those. Usually you get one or two per mission, but we just got really lucky that our crew, first of all, was good enough to handle that. And being able to just integrate all that new science that would come up on those vehicles was pretty special. We also did a lot of spacewalks, as you mentioned earlier, so we had a busy 6 months, for sure.
That's incredible. So talk about this special thing that happened around Christmas. You got to do something that was really, really sort of unheard of in a way.
It really was. It was, God continues to amaze me and open doors in my life that I never would have imagined. So a friend of mine was bugging me from probably the time I got on station until Christmas Day that, hey, you need to read the Christmas story from the space station, you know.
Like I told Crowder not to keep telling me that, yeah. Like, over and over.
And I was like, no, we can't do that. It's against the rules. And, you know, finally I was like, all right, I'll ask just to see if, see them laugh at me. But anyway, I asked, and the answer was sure. I was just like, wow, okay. So then it was like full on. So this incredible chance to experience God and to share that experience with a lot of people is just unheard of, to do that from the space station. So I had this Bible up there with me. So this has also been 70 million miles. And so I whipped it out to Luke 2 that day, and I sat in the cupola with the earth underneath me looking at it, and I read Luke 2 over the I didn't just read it to myself, I read it over the official NASA communication channels to all the mission control centers around the world. So God just completely opened that door. So it's incredible.
I think there's a great lesson in that, Shane, because most of the people sitting here today obviously aren't pastors or people that, you know, that's what they do all day long, and it's, you just can't roll into your company sometimes, right, and start reading scripture over the intercom. And I think maybe the lesson is partially that God favored you, that you got a yes when you weren't sure that you would, and you expect to get a no, but maybe that was a part of the years and years and years and years of the life that you lived, the example that you lived, the way that you treated and respected the boundaries of being an astronaut. And I think we can say this today, but that your words at Passion were measured. Absolutely. And my questions were measured. Mm-hmm. And it was understood that you're a person of faith in Christ, but this isn't going to be like a message. And I think that everybody gets that here that's in a business and knows I can't walk in every single day and talk about Jesus. But I believe that if people are faithful along the way, that at some point God's going to do that thing and open that door and make that way. And Nick Foles is going to stand on national TV and say, I believe in Jesus and I want people to know that I love him. And this is my moment, you know? So how great that you had that moment. And also, you're one of the few people who's ever read God's word in space before, over the earth on Christmas Day. What an amazing thought that is. Incredible. I thought it was pretty amazing anyway. I'd clap for that. So we, you want to say something about that? We were at lunch this week, Ryan McCormick and myself, talking about this interview and talking about what should we ask. And I said, well, I want to ask him what would happen in the event of a catastrophic power failure on Earth. Like, what do you do if you're stuck up 254 miles from space? Right when I was saying that to Ryan, our server walked by, and he said, he just leaned in and said, do you mind if I ask what y'all are talking about? I said, well, we're interviewing an astronaut in a few days, and we're thinking about good questions to ask an astronaut. And he's like, you're doing what? I said, yes, we're going to interview an astronaut. Where? At church. Why? What church? Asenia is in Louisiana visiting his mom today in New Orleans, so he's watching this later on the podcast. But he said, well, here's what I want to ask him. He said, I want to know, how long are you in space before you get bored?
Well, that's an easy answer. I never got bored, honestly. I mean, it's incredible. You have a lot to do up there. Just so you know, we're on Greenwich Mean Time, so it's the time it is in London. We get up at 6 a.m. We go to bed at 10 p.m., 8-hour sleep period every night. We work from 7:30 to 7:30 every day. That's our work day. So we are cranking and rocking and rolling all day, Monday through Friday. That's kind of a standard week. Now, we don't get all our weekends off, but Saturday mornings, if you might imagine, we have this big office building floating in space. And guess what? It needs to get cleaned, but we don't have a cleaning staff that comes and does that for us. So we clean all Saturday morning, like 3 or 4
no
hours.
No one has ever had that thought in their life. So, Part of being an astronaut is you clean the International Space Station.
We're wiping things
down. What do you clean what? Like, how do you... Wow.
Well, we create a lot of trash and mess, and things are floating around everywhere. So we have vents that pull a lot of the junk away, and we're just vacuuming those out and changing them out when we need to. So we're bona fide cleaners as well, I guess, as an astronaut. So that's our Saturday mornings, and kind of the benefit of that is we get Saturday afternoons in general off and Sundays off. So you may think we get bored then, but never did. So we have incredible capability, like you talked about. I could call friends, call home. I talked to Robbie every day on the phone. That was amazing. Every day I was gone. The kids 2 or 3 times a week, depending on their schedule. We could watch movies, watch TV shows. I mean, we were not roughing it up there, let me tell you. So and to be in a kind of an outpost like that, we had a lot of amenities, I would say. So that was cool, just looking at Earth, taking pictures, enjoying our crewmates, sharing life with them, and enjoying all the different cultures involved. So I was there with the Japanese, the French, Russians, and U.S. So just kind of learning each other's cultures was absolutely fascinating to me. So never got bored. I mean, who would get bored when you can just fly around all the time? I mean, that's a simple way to put it, but no kidding, just flying around. Well, let me see how far I can fly today without touching a wall. You know, you're playing silly games with yourself, or let me do 3 or 4 flips this time instead of just one. And so we kind of play stupid astronaut games, maybe.
And then you had Sundays off as well, I'm guessing, or
Sundays were
Chick-fil-A was closed.
Me, Sundays are pretty special to me. I would get up, work out first thing in the morning, have no kidding, Passion, all Passion's albums, shuffling, cranking on the space station every Sunday morning. They got me through my workouts and just super encouraging to me and my crewmates, whether they wanted it or not. So that was cool. And then after my workout, I would go back to my little crew quarters, hang out there, and watch your podcast every week. So it was incredible for all that to happen. Again, your teams and NASA teams making sure that I could stay connected with you guys and continue to worship the way I normally do on Earth.
Wow. So many things we want to talk about, but I saw a little clip come up a second ago. You spent some time outside, as you say. Can you just talk about what that feels like to know that I'm kind of looking in this video, and that cable, I guess, partly is what's holding you from going off into Never Never Land.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's our safety tether. Those things are 85 feet long, so no kidding, we could be, you know, completely across this auditorium. But when I got here, if I wanted to work right here, I couldn't like use both my hands because if I let go, this thing would pull me all the way back over there. Really bad form. Don't want to do that. So you put another smaller tether on to hold you in place locally, we call it. But that is an incredible thing. If we had a really bad day and all those kind of broke or you forgot to hook it up and you went floating off, we have a jetpack on our back to fly us back on, believe it or not. But you don't want to be the first person to use that, right? You get it named after you. It's really bad form. And, so we try
so
to avoid that.
Nobody's ever had to do that before.
Not like, for real. Just on testing, but not for real. So anyway, so they're not going to come get you. That's the thing. They're going to move the space station around to come get you. So we're very careful.
So what is the worst case scenario plan? Like, let's say that somebody does something crazy on Earth and blows up a nuclear bomb and the power grid goes out for a month and you're stuck up in space, disconnected from things, or there's a fire, or all the things that you trained for. How do you get out of that thing?
So for things on Earth, that's one, I'll talk about that issue first. So we're completely self-sustaining up there. We do get obviously tons of help from the mission control centers around the world. So if that piece was gone, we can still survive. We're getting all our power from the sun. Every time we go around, every 45 minutes, we're sucking all the sun's rays into our solar arrays. So life on board wouldn't change, except for the piece, the disconnect between Earth and the communications there. But we have several things that we train for that are really bad days on the space station, like a fire or an ammonia leak or depressurization. So any of those things happen, we're all trained over and over and over to make sure we can respond to those things. The worst case, if it got really bad on one of those events, we have our Soyuz spacecraft that we launched in that's still attached, and that's our lifeboat. So we would just hop in there and detach, undock, and come home. So there's always a way out. You're never going to have too many astronauts up there with not enough seats. So we make sure that happens.
But how many people went up on that spacecraft? Three.
Three of us.
But six of you could come back.
So they have
people sitting on people's laps.
No, the other three have their own spacecraft. It's
okay,
because
they, I got gotcha.
All right, so they'll come in theirs, and we'll go in ours.
I'm going to sleep better tonight. I'm going to feel, because there's six people up there right now, and I'm going to feel, I'm going to sleep better about that tonight. I'll talk about two real fast things. Your family, just, I want you to talk about that, because people here are balancing the sacrifice of career and family. People have dreams, gifts, abilities, opportunity, right, aptitude, and yet we all have families, and there's a balance between that. And not only is it time away, which you've experienced 189 days living outside of the Earth, but, I mean, there are a lot of people here who spent that many days away from their family on their business last year. Mm-hmm. But there's also that you went on a rocket somewhere factor, Shane. And it didn't dawn on me till we were at your launch going up on the Soyuz, and I didn't get to be in Kazakhstan, but that wasn't my fault. That was the Russians' fault. And so I ended up not getting to make that trip, but Shelley and I were at Mission Control right behind the glass with your kids and your family and your close friends. And I don't know, it just kind of hit me like a ton of bricks that I was, you know, 2 or 3 feet away from your children who were watching their dad, I almost got emotional. And I'm with an astronaut, so they're not going to do that because it's not allowed. Shane got emotional back in 1974, I heard. Is that about close, Robbie? 73. I realized how proud they were of you. I was sitting there watching. I could see your son, Zach, out of the corner of my eye. Your daughters were behind us, and I could just see how proud he was of you going up to space on this rocket. And but then I could also feel the hope in his heart, you know, that you actually made it into orbit, because that doesn't happen every time. And talk about the cost and how do you work that out of pursuing, as you said, wanting to do things that have never been done before, but yet knowing that there's a cost in that, and especially as it relates to your family.
Right, so there's obviously a lot of risk. There was when I was in the military as well, so we kind of had that bit set in our mind, and we dealt with similar things before. When we were in the military in general, when I was deploying, we didn't have kids, so that was a different dynamic. Now that we're, you know, when I did my shuttle launch, the kids were 8 and 10, and they didn't completely grasp really the risk involved then. They were just happy that they were there with their cousins on the beach in Florida, which some of those cousins are here in the room today. But they just had a great time, and that's really the way Robbie and I would want it, right? We want them to enjoy themselves. Robbie's managing all the stress. What a rock she is and has been for our family to really hold us together. If I'm the colonel, she's absolutely the general, and running the show and keeping our family together. Now this experience was different. You were there with my kids. I didn't get to experience that, but I saw videos that people sent me of that room and those moments that you told me, and it made me really proud of my kids for just being as strong as they were in a kind of a difficult time. But, you know, it's kind of funny because kids keep you humble, as you know, if you're a parent. And, you know, shortly after I got to orbit, I'm getting calculus questions from my daughters. Can you do this, Dad? I can't figure it out. You know, and it just kind of brings you down to earth. I'm like, well, if I can't figure it out, somebody up here can. And we'll get you the answer, you know. And so little things
our
like that.
Our tax dollars at work makes
that's
me
right,
feel fantastic.
Right. So even outer space, we're having to do some homework for our kids. So that was kind of cool. It kept it real. And it just let me know that they were okay and that they were just trying to do life as normal as they used to know it.
So. Yeah, talking about keeping you grounded, you ended up having to come home. Your mission was extended. I wish we could talk about that a little bit because there were some other complications that made you stay in space
six weeks longer.
Mm-hmm. So you were already like, I'm coming home. Right. And then you got the news, no, I'm going to be here a lot longer. You missed some birthdays. You missed some significant things. And you had to reset your mind.
Absolutely.
But then you got back in that spacecraft, and I mean, the way you guys come home is phenomenal. I mean, space shuttle would glide in, right?
Right.
No engine power.
Nope.
Glide in.
Nice runway you land on. Beautiful.
In California
smooth.
Or Florida.
Right.
In and out, you know, is waiting for you nearby. But the Russians, they take it to a whole new level. This is you coming down on the Soyuz capsule.
Crew now bracing for touchdown that is coming up within the minute.
It looks so peaceful here. Watch after we land. Welcome back to Earth. So watch what we do next. So our parachute inflates here.
And
we get
touchdown
tumbling
is now
a little
confirmed.
Bit.
Touchdown confirmed at 6:20 and 35 seconds.
Drug a little bit more.
Central time.
So we got a bonus ride. See that helicopter there? I used to train to shoot those down, and then I was actually flying away in that thing after I landed. I'm like, this is really weird. I don't know what's going on here.
I'll tell you what's really weird is let's just send them down and let them smash into Kazakhstan. How did you describe that, what that feels
so
like?
So it's really like a really bad car crash where you just get smacked from behind. It's, believe it or not, very safe. It's super reliable. The seats actually stroke tremendously to allow us not to get injured, and our seats are formed to our specific back. So no injuries, and we get pulled out of there by the search and rescue team shortly after that, maybe 10 minutes after we landed, and then we get in and kind of sit out in the tundra there and smell fresh air for the first time in 6 months and just realize how incredible our planet is.
You have a view that we don't have. So how has your relationship with God, or has your relationship with God changed because you've been in space?
Yeah.
And what ways would you encourage us today in our relationship with God?
So it's an amazing perspective. We talked about it a little bit already. I wouldn't say it changed much up there. It just, all the beliefs I'd had growing up and throughout my adult life were just reinforced. There's no doubt that there's a God that created all this. It's absolutely magical, majestic to view our planet from that perspective. And so hopefully you guys will have a little bit of deeper sense for what that's like, just seeing some of the pictures that astronauts send down or hearing from other astronauts or folks like myself that are believers, because it's the real deal. We're so honored to represent humanity. We're not representing a country. It's a huge responsibility to represent all of humanity up there. And God has obviously put me here for a reason, and I'm continuing to see what that next chapter is going to be like working for Him.
Well, you've done a great job with the sack of gold God gave you.
Thank you.
You've done an amazing job with the talent that He gave you, Shane, to take that and to not bury it or blow mm-hmm. through it like we talked about last week, mm-hmm. but to boost it, no pun intended, but to take it, you know, to its maximum level. And you've inspired all of us today, both here at Cumberland, with the pursuit of excellence, the price that you've been willing to pay. And I just want to say to you again, as your friend, thank you for serving humanity and for giving your life to better the lives of all people on planet Earth. We're grateful for that.
Absolutely.
Let's thank Shane Cumberland, 515. Let's say thank you to Shane Kimbrough. Love you.